Normally, when I introduce a downstream, I set up a question which gets answered in the broader chat. But talking to George the Poet isn't really a straightforward question and answer. He's a poet, a rapper, an academic, and an author. And speaking with him is a bit like climbing into a spaceship and taking a tour of the constellations of someone's thinking. In a nutshell, we're talking about what it means to be black. But in reality, we're covering everything from imperialism to Tupac Shakur and Kendrick Lamar, political assassinations, how the West killed off a cadre of black radical leadership. This is one of the most expansive and freewheeling interviews I've ever done for this show, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. My first question is actually really different from the one that I've got written down, and I think this is the question I've always wanted to ask you, which is how did you develop your poetic voice? The rhythm, the cadence, the timbre. What was the story?
I think I outline it a little bit in the book. It really starts with me developing as a grime MC. There's a certain foundational discipline that went into that in terms of how we put our ideas together, what our artistic priorities are. So rhyming has always been a high priority. And then I reached a point when I got to uni where I had already built up some reservations about certain elements of the art form that we grew up in, grime. And one of them was the bravado that always comes with it. I wanted to strip that back. I was also aware that not everyone can listen as fast as we talk.
Mm.
So I wanted to slow it down and make it more conversational, and it just became the poetry that I do today.
Who are the grime MCs that were most influential for you?
Without a doubt, it was definitely Wiley, Skepta, and Getz. A little later on in my life, it then became, he's not strictly a grime MC, but he was in grime. Wretch Free 2, and in my generation, people like Chip and Criminal, they were just, they were prolific. They worked really hard and they built something that I was endlessly inspired by.
So I worked with Wretch Free 2 on his book, and speaking to him is just incredible because you ask him a question and he travels inwards for a bit, and then it's like he pulls up water from a deep well within him and he answers in full paragraphs. And one of the things that he said to me about grime is that it was the first cultural art form that felt truly black British. And it was when he was listening to Scars the remix, and it was one of Wiley's verses where it's like, enough of them are my youth, enough of them are minor. And he was like, that's black British. It's not American anymore.
Yeah.
This is where we're from. And it's a reflection of the ethnic groups in London at that time.
And that's powerful when you're entering adolescence, as I was at the advent of grime. I didn't want an American voice. It didn't feel like American hip hop was speaking directly to our experience. I was stepping out into the world and we definitely had our own thing. So to have a soundtrack to it was beautiful.
I mean, it's also like, you know, American hip hop at the time, it's like, you know what? I'm not drinking Cristal and I'm not wearing Versace.
Right. We weren't. America was our big brother for a long time. You know, a lot of British artists don't like to admit it, but if you look back at the videos, the music videos at the time, we were all dressed in American wear.
Yeah.
And we were just coming out of spitting with an American twang.
Yeah.
It was amazing to find something that was our own. And in many ways, that was the beginning of me starting to identify my political position in the world.
What? I'm so off track from all the questions I had written down, which I promise I'll get back to. But, you know, that first point where grime's coming out, you've got this diction where it's shaped by the Caribbean and it's shaped by Cockney at the same time. And you'll have an artist like Wiley who was switching between the two, sometimes in the same track.
Yeah.
And now you've got an influence where you can really feel the impact of West Africa on it. For you, in terms of developing your voice, you know, obviously you're growing up around people from the Caribbean, but your own background is from Uganda. How did you start bringing that into what you were saying and how you were saying it?
It's a great question, Ash. for me, I started off by deliberately engaging with Uganda more. So we all had a few trips when we were younger with our parents, very different to being there as a young adult. So when I was 19, I started taking myself there independently. And I experienced something similar to what Nipsey Hussle, God rest his soul, described when he first went home, you know, as a break from the LA scene. And, you know, sort of a, I don't know, I felt like there had been something missing, which Uganda was able to give me. But I didn't really know how to interweave Ugandan styles and sounds. Over time, I committed to just talking about Uganda a bit more. But that was in my poetry era. Mm. I didn't really know how to do that as a gram artist. And it's been amazing to watch since the rise of Afro swing in this country, which I talk about in my book a little as well.
You talk about J-Hus being this moment of ushering in Afro swing to the UK.
Undeniably. I think J-Hus was at the forefront of that generation. And there were other pioneers in it as well. Of course, there was Young Bane. Of course, NSG, J5, their whole movement. Kojo Funds. You know, there was a lot going on to really, again, stamp that we are here. This is the African contingent now of Black Britain.
One of the things that you write in the book is that there has been a tendency amongst Black and brown people in the West to think about the project of political liberation as being getting a bigger slice of the pie here.
Right.
And that's a pie which has been made by empire, by slavery, by colonialism. And actually the project is to engage with what's going on back home. And for me, there are some parallels between what you're saying and J-Hus's first album and his second album. The first one is like so bombastic and so much fun. And then the second one is this journey inwards.
Yeah.
And it's into paranoia and it's into depression and it's about feeling close to death. And that's when you get the sense that Africa isn't there just as a form of music and a beat.
Mm.
But he's going, how do I relate to this history when I've been displaced from it by so much violence?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a real powerful analysis. And I wish I heard more of that in our media spaces anyway. Ultimately, I have had a growing concern that there's something about our lives out here. And not to talk about Black people business inappropriately, I do think this applies. I was just having a deep conversation with my driver over here. He's from Brazil. He's been here for 20 years. So I think many immigrants can relate to this. And I also think much of the British working class can relate to it. But there is an element of alienation, an element of isolation, and I guess atomization. Maybe all of those words are the same thing. Think about it. Our lives feel increasingly detached from each other and from some kind of intrinsic sense of purpose. I have witnessed that across my generation. A lot of people have slipped into depressive phases, episodes in their life, not as a result of anything not based in their material reality. You know, like it's disconcerting for a lot of people trying to figure out what we're supposed to be doing.
Samuel Taylor Coleridge had a great word for that called the objective correlative.
There you go. Oh my God, you just brought back A-level English lit.
Yeah, because that's him talking about Hamlet, because he's going, why is Hamlet so upset?
Yeah, you remember that? Yeah, the objective correlative.
It lacks objective correlative.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So yeah, I think my obsession with music is that it's always a prism through which we can explore some of this stuff.
Mm. In the book, you're writing about what you call a war on Blackness. What is that war? And how does it manifest?
So the war on Blackness is ultimately, it's like a symphony of forces that some appear overtly rooted in history and the legacy of colonialism and slavery. And others feel more like, or are presented to us, more like an unfortunate byproduct of a world in which Black people haven't quite got their stuff together. So ultimately what we have is a political disunity. We have a persistent economic strain or inability to build our momentum. And then there is the objective, undeniable fact of the world's racial ordering, which Afro-pessimism has done a lot to present in the mainstream as anti-blackness. This is an objective fact and it manifests itself in different ways. So I look at the war on blackness as the sum of all of those things, which has just a deleterious effect on peoples of African descent.
So like one of the things that you often hear from the right is, sure, in the past you had de jure segregation, right? By law, you had these things which said that black people can't participate in the institutions which confer value and social life.
Mm-hmm.
But those barriers have been dropped now, and it's not our fault if you can't catch up with us.
Right.
What's your response to those people?
I feel that those people, what I notice when I listen to them, because I do try and listen to them, what I notice is that they have no analysis of imperialism. They have no concept of the continuity between the colonial order, what the aims of the colonial era were, and what the results were. You know, the results were a world in which, yeah, we are connected through, I don't know if you want to call it capital, if you want to call it trade, what all these different relationships that are economic in character. We are connected, but there's definitely a balance of power that is not in favor of the resource-rich areas of the world, that is not in favor of those who have contributed objectively the most labor to this system, right? So without looking at what the intention of the colonial era were, you know, the idea that you guys went out into the world for a reason. I don't know if you've ever watched footage of the Atlantic Ocean, trying to cross the Atlantic Ocean. Mm. Contemporary footage of it is scary enough. So if you imagine 400, 500, 600 years ago, you lot were making that journey for whatever reason. And there was an outcome.
Oh, isn't it to civilize the rest of the world?
Right. I know you were so passionate about sharing Christianity and commerce and civilization. But, you know, at great risk, you did all of this. And by some estimates, you were able to siphon trillions, tens of trillions in wealth over centuries. There has to be a consequence to that, right? Especially given that there has been no reckoning. There's been no official legal process trying to assess exactly what the effect of that was, and therefore what should, you know, how justice should be represented or manifest in our modern era. So, yeah, since I hear that consistent, or I notice that consistent blind spot in a lot of these commentators, I wouldn't say it's all bad faith conversation, but it is, it's conversation and analysis that is deeply lacking.
Well, it feels to me that what they're doing is that they look at, as you say, the objective facts of global inequality, right? Global wealth disparities.
Mm.
And they go, well, I'm going to explain that by saying you're inferior. And I might find fancy ways of saying that. I might talk about culture. I might talk about corruption.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I'm saying you guys are inferior and that's why you can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, they're drawing on a very deep well of arguments, of pseudoscience, of religion, or manipulation of religious doctrine. And these things have just mutated from century to century, generation to generation, such that now when they talk about corruption, for example, in Africa, they believe it to be of different character than the corruption in Europe and the West and, you know, all of their allies. So the racism doesn't occur to them as racism. It occurs to them as a home truth.
Mm. There's a popular understanding about the relationship between Africa and Europe and America. And that popular understanding, I think you could crudely call it the charity advert understanding,
right?
Here are these hungry, distended bellied children, and they just need more stuff from us. And we're propping up this failing civilization. We're rich and we're giving our surplus to them and hoping that that's going to change something. How true is it that the West is rich and Africa is poor?
I think Michael Parenti said it best. It's the other way around. The resource-rich parts of the world, that's wealth. That is where wealth is derived from. What has been happening for hundreds of years is that that wealth has been extracted from the places that it is native to, and it has been flipped, it has been applied to an economic system that places more value on, you know, the processes and the people, more importantly, that convert those raw resources into goods and services and whatever else goes on that makes this place feel so exclusive. By this place, I mean, you know, the global north, the imperial north. So ultimately, what you have is an inverse situation where the places that are actually wealthy and the populations that are native and are the rightful custodians of that wealth, they are made poor. They are impoverished. They are not only separated from their natural heritage in terms of the land, but they are also made to run on a treadmill of, I'm trying not to use too many like overly jargony words.
Go on. We've got a jargon familiar audience.
It's true, actually. So that via the process of proletarianization, these people have been alienated from their land and alienated from their labor. And ultimately, they're not able to get ahead in a system that requires that relationship. So ultimately, yeah, over time, you get these deteriorating trade dynamics whereby the increasing wealth that the West and the global North is able to extract from the world, from the global South, is never able to be matched by the either stagnation or the, you know, decreasing wealth of the undervalued labor of the global South.
And where it seems to me you see that changing in a very big way is China. So China had been proletarianized. We in the West thought, you know what, we don't even need our industrial base anymore. We're just going to use theirs. And they're not really going to be able to climb the value chain and they're going to be stuck where they are, which is just making the shit that we consume. And China is like, yeah, we'll make the shit that you consume and we'll do an awful lot more besides.
100%.
And the political class in Washington and Westminster is going, wait a minute.
Right.
You're not a threat to our interests.
Right. I don't know if you saw one of these ghouls the other day talking about China being too big. Yeah. Objectively, China's too big and it's dangerous for the world. I forget.
Andrew Marr, I think it was.
No. I know Andrew Marr got the got the pasting, which you got covered very well, but no, I'm talking about an American politician, Victoria Nuland adjacent. It wasn't her. It was Janet Aspen.
There
I think it was her. I think it was her. Anyway, yeah, acting like the rise of China is just unfair. I'm like, what happened to the free market, guys? But yeah, ultimately, China decided to invest in its productive capacity, which, you know, the West gave up on that model a long time ago, right? And again, a lot of the reasoning behind the rise of neoliberalism, which has led to our financialized economy as opposed to what it was once, an industrialized productive economy, part of the mythology was that above all, above democracy, capital needs special protection. Protections from people, protection from politics. Once upon a time, that was a fringe position. It's now mainstream.
It seems to me that a gamble of neoliberalism as it was understood in America and Britain was that you could keep a racist division of labor in place forever. And I'm not saying that there isn't a racist division of labor, but ultimately, if a country is growing its industrial base enough, its productive base enough, because we're feeding it with our consumptive habits,
right,
it's not going to accept its place in your global pecking order.
Right.
Forever.
Now, the reason I'm a fan of Navarra is you guys talk about that stuff. We all know that the policy of mainstream media in this country is not to talk about it or to sabotage the conversation, to subvert the conversation in the interest of the ruling class. So ultimately, I keep saying ultimately,
I always say fundamentally. That's my crush.
You do say fundamentally a lot.
Fundamentally.
I've actually noticed that. So thank you for making me feel not weird about ultimately the fact being that we are up against a mainstream culture that doesn't want to speak honestly about what is really bugging this ruling class and why we are being told constantly that the scariest thing to happen in our generation is the rise of China. Like pulling, like the global south pulling itself out of poverty isn't what the aim was supposed to be.
Precisely, precisely. Talking about the global scale of black dispossession, right? Expropriation from African people and African descended people. There would be lots of people, particularly people who work in music, who say, well, the answer to that is black capital.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
I actually want to put a disclaimer because I can feel my nerves building up and I want to explain why I'm nervous. For a long time, I was uncritical of these mainstream trends. There's been a turning point in my life over the past 4 years, I'd say, where I've just done a lot of reflecting and I've finally broken free from a lot of these myths and a lot of this misdirection. So, and I'm speaking to a heavyweight right now who is, you know,
flyweight,
who is very much made her stance known. You've been politically way more on point than I have been for a long time. So I also feel I want to, you know, also give a word to people that feel that they are not native to these conversations and not 100% confident in these conversations. I am also coming out of a phase of feeling like that. A lot of people associated me with social commentary and political commentary, but I feel that I was politically undercooked for a long time, as I talk about in my book. But yeah, a large part of the reason for that was my involvement in the artist community, especially the black artist community, which is politically used for purposes of propaganda, right? Black music has been taken away from any kind of radical analysis, which it once had at its core, which elements of hip hop, of spoken word, of, you know, the Gil Scott Heron, Last Poets generation of spoken word artists. These were radicals, reggae, radical music at the start. And ultimately now, what we have is a scene full of individualized success stories, people that are not attached to any class consciousness, not attached to any national story or any kind of emancipation struggle or tradition in the way that, for example, Tupac was, which is why Tupac gets a chapter in this book. So yeah, we're told that success is you having a good run, making money for yourself and for the people around you. We're discouraged from looking at the ratios, like how many of us who are trying to become artists professionally are able to do that viably and at what cost?
I mean, it seems to me that what Jay-Z and, you know, Diddy before he went on the run were saying is that we're trying to create a black ownership class.
Right.
So they did have a kind of class consciousness. It wasn't a proletarian bottom-up class consciousness.
Yeah, and I was thinking about this in the context of someone who's being discussed quite a lot nowadays, Kendrick Lamar. Kendrick and J. Cole. Very, very funny situation over the past few weeks has unfolded. Kendrick dropped a verse insisting that he was the number one guy and
it's
he has no competition.
I'm
just Big Me. There is no Big Free. Forget Drake, forget J. Cole. And I wasn't too impressed by this. I felt like it spoke to the immaturity of hip hop that at a time where there is a lot going on, the most successful conscious rappers have nothing to say about some of the elephants in the room, whether it be Gaza, whether it be Haiti, just across the water from them. As a community, hip hop is up in flames about this this new verse. That bothered me, but I understand that I am speaking from a non-mainstream perspective. So there's that.
But when Kendrick made To Pimp a Butterfly, that was a political album. It was very much from his point of view, and it was about the traumas of racial violence and artistic responses to it. But I would say that's a political album. It might not be as explicitly political or radical as something like Gil Scott-Heron, but it was political. And now it just seems like the only story he wants to tell is, I'm at the top.
Tell them, Ash. You tell them. Because they fought me when I said this.
But I love Kendrick. I love Kendrick,
yeah.
But my secret is that I wrote my master's thesis about Good Kid, M.A.A.D. City.
Oh, nah, come on, man. Because you get more respect from that. Yeah. Just,
as an album, I was like, this is complete. And this is storytelling and it's experimental and it's interesting.
Right.
But now it's like, you know, J. Cole. I mean, Drake's going to do what Drake does, right? He's not a political artist, that's fine.
Drake just doesn't even feature in this conversation, in this element of the conversation. Yeah. But sorry to jump in there. This is what happens when a culture of radical analysis or analysis in general is not cultivated within hip-hop. Hip-hop has, not through its own fault generally. I wouldn't say this is primarily a grassroots issue. I would say this is a top-down issue. I would say this issue is political in nature. I would say the leadership of hip-hop has been political in nature and has been has prioritized capitalistic values at the expense of others. So Kendrick being this long in the hip-hop mainstream without any, you know, radical input in his life, any political work, any you know, critical reading and commitment to learning. Without that, after a while, after 10 years of being successful, there's not much to say other than I am successful. I'm the best because, relative to what's going on, I guess you could make that argument.
I mean, it's something that you write in the book, which is, you know, there are benefits and dangers in writing from your own experience, right? The benefits are that, of course, you can have this very authentic, here is my vantage point, and it feels exciting. It's like discovering a new person. It's always like falling in love with a new person. But then if that's all you do from album to album, book to book, how many stories do you have to tell unless you're reaching outside of yourself?
Right.
So, I mean, how did you expand your vantage point and your hinterland, both as an artist and also as a social commentator?
Yeah. Well, I've been fortunate. It is very important to say that there are environmental factors and things that I couldn't control that allowed me to look beyond my narrative, allowed me to look at that cycle within hip hop from the outside as a consumer and as a someone who's critical of the genre endlessly. The first thing I did was pivot to Africa. You know, I started paying attention to what was going on in the continent. I always felt insecure about the fact that I didn't grow up in Africa and therefore I wasn't the strongest commentator on issues of an African nature. Started paying a bit more attention to Ugandan politics, but also to Pan-African discourse in general. I think what really brought this into focus for me was when it emerged that there were slave markets in Libya. We had a big moment about it in the mainstream, in hip hop, in black culture, where we were outraged and then it kind of went away. And the repeated cases of police brutality in America and over here just made me think we are definitely in a cycle. We're on a what I call in the book, a treadmill of debate. We're going to continue talking about this. And that is definitely convenient for those who don't want to change the status quo. So I was like, look, how are we going to get off the treadmill of debate? And how are we going to be able to join up our trauma, join up our struggle? Because that question really started bothering me after I turned about 25. I just persisted in putting myself in Africa, speaking to Africans and looking for sources of Pan-African analysis. And that's what really drew me out of talking about myself. I was like, oh, as long as I'm here and I have a voice in Black British culture, what I can definitely do is start to map out our experience and use it to triangulate the appropriate politics for our community.
I mean, me and Jonah, who's the invisible silent partner Downstream, were talking about this before you came. And I was talking about going to Bangladesh and India when I was a teenager. And that was an extraordinarily difficult trip. One, because I felt screamingly inauthentic. Mm. I felt so Western when I was there. Don't speak the language, wearing jeans and a t-shirt, that kind of thing. Secondly, my mum was saying, "You're coming home." And I was like, "I feel like I'm leaving home." And so there were really different expectations, even like within the family. And that, you know, the third thing was obviously you're confronted with inequality and poverty, unlike anything you'd ever see in London. And that has, if I'm honest, created a reluctance in me to explore that aspect of my identity or take seriously the idea of going back again. What for you were the differences between going to Uganda as a child, where the experience is being mediated by your family's expectations of what that's going to be like, and then going back again as a young man, looking to shape your own identity, looking to establish a political narrative for yourself?
Yeah, I think it's a huge difference, and it's something that I would encourage my young audience, especially those who are from Africa or from the Global South, I would encourage you to try and walk that line. Because when you go there independently and you start to figure out your own agenda, what I found and what I hope for you guys is that you find your peers. You start to look at your home country from a generational lens. Your peers will have a read of the situation that your parents might not be able to offer you. And through your peers, you will be able to imagine either the contribution you would like to make or who you could have been if you were there. You know, I relate to a lot of young Ugandan men who they did what their parents asked of them. They went to school, they went to uni, they got a job, but ultimately they've ended up as Uber drivers. Ultimately, they're Uber drivers. Because there's a very unforgiving job market, and the priorities of their political context is not employment for them. It's not giving them a meaningful life. So I understand that in a way that I wouldn't if I didn't go back as a young adult. I was there when we all started uni. I was there when we started making music. I've seen what the musicians in Uganda in my generation have gone on to do and what their prospects would have been in the West. And I just, you know, I would encourage others to like, just know that you have counterparts over there that would love to connect with you.
What are the differences in your mind between American and British expressions of blackness?
One thing that I've learned about American blackness is that when they say black, many of them mean African American. Black for many of them is the word that they have for their cultural milieu, for their cultural distinction. Black doesn't necessarily mean the skin, doesn't necessarily mean Africa. So I feel that what has happened in that case is a form of blackness has grown up colonized, it's grown up kind of cut off from the African context, and it's grown up and largely had to identify itself in opposition to white imperial Americanness. Sometimes in concert with white imperial Americanness. Of course, there is a very rich and deep tradition of black radicalism from black America. I've drawn on it heavily, and most of my favorite commentators right now from a black radical perspective are Americans.
Like who?
Dr. Jared Ball, Dr. She's called CBS for short, but Cherise Burden Stully? I never say her full name out loud. Dr. Joy James, Daruba Bin Wahad. These are very influential voices in my life, and they give contemporary analysis. And I kind of defer to them when there's anything in worth discussing in American life. But at the same time, British blackness draws from a hybrid of many African and Caribbean diasporas who more recently came over, who have only recently removed themselves from a predominantly Black, whether it be Caribbean or African context. And with that come slightly different sensibilities, slightly different alignment, a slightly stronger sense of affinity to somewhere that is not the metropole, you know, the imperial metropole that we've ended up in.
There's also the relationships between different immigrant groups that you get in Britain a lot more simply because we're a smaller country.
True.
So it's a lot harder to have monocultures other than white monocultures like around the city of Bath. But like it's a lot harder to have a monoculture if you find a, you know, Caribbean community somewhere in London. That's also going to be where you find South Asians and people from Latin America and Polish people and Irish people. And so there is that sort of hybrid identity within different Black ethnic groups and then across immigrant ethnic groups as well that's going on.
Yeah, and you know, I just mentioned Darubo Bin Wahad. Recently, there was the 55th anniversary of one of New York State's longest running trials. It was called, at least one longest conspiracy trial, was called the Panther 21, where the East Coast leadership of the Black Panther Party was on trial for apparently, allegedly, trying to blow up some police stations. Tupac's mom was in the Panther 21, and so was Darubo Bin Wahad. He was reflecting on it and explaining the difference, or explaining elements of the split between the East Coast Black Panthers and the West Coast Black Panthers. And he said, look, on the East Coast, us being in Harlem, for example, where Tupac's mom was, we are from the tradition of Garveyism. That's where Marcus Garvey set up base. That's where Malcolm X used to preach on the street, you know, used to engage in activism for the Nation of Islam. And ultimately, we're from a milieu that sees itself, you know, closer to Africa. So we used to have all sorts of African names. And ultimately, on the West Coast, there was a different nature to their migration. A lot of them came, ended up in the West Coast as a result of wars in the Pacific. You know, there was a migration from the South, not just by Black Americans, but by white Americans. And many of them didn't get that connection to Africa. In fact, when that connection started showing up, a lot of the time it was in questionable ways through people that ultimately turned out to be, you know, collaborating with American intelligence. And this led to internal conflict. But the fundamental point he made was that your social setting has a big impact on your on the expression of your activism and your politics, even when you share those politics with others in a different setting.
He's come up a few times now, so let's talk about him. Who is Tupac to you?
Tupac Shakur was the son of Afeni Shakur, who, like I said, was a Black Panther. His stepfather was also a Black Panther. His father was a Black Panther at some point, but so was his stepfather, Mutulu Shakur. Mutulu Shakur, since the age of 19, was under surveillance by the FBI. Tupac was first pulled out of school and interrogated about his stepfather's whereabouts when he was around 10 years old, I believe, or under 10 years old. Around that same time in his life, a pastor of who was in his life at the time reported that when he asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up, he said he wanted to be a revolutionary. This is who Tupac was. He was the child of revolutionaries. He grew up in a revolutionary context.
Aunt being Asata Shakur, right?
Right. Asata Shakur is said to have been his godmother. So the Shakurs were at the core of the Black liberation movement, the militant wing. They had a radical analysis, a Marxist analysis. I think he dated the daughter of the head of the Communist Party USA when he was in school. And his early raps were songs like Panther Power, where he's articulating the case for Black nationalism and Black militancy. The Tupac that many of us know is a gangster rapper.
We know All Eyes on Me Tupac.
The All Eyes on Me Tupac, the last living Tupac that we saw, who was by all definitions, a conflicted man, a man who was, I used to think of him as a distracted man. You know, he was, I thought that he was just his vices. Hollywood was a vice of his and it pulled him in all sorts of directions. But looking at it with a more mature lens, one that is a little bit better versed in some of the tactics of American intelligence, the subversive tactics that he used to break down the American left, which Dr. CBS, Charisse Burden Staley, talks about in her new book, Black Scare, Red Scare.
Mm-hmm.
Tupac was a clear target of American intelligence. It's just the most obvious thing. There's a great book by, I think he's an investigative journalist called John Potash, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur, in which you can see, you know, we all know that he got beaten up by the police the minute he got famous. We all know that he went to prison a couple of times for things that he vehemently denies. Well, one thing that he vehemently denied, another thing that he actually accepts, but at the same time, he was like, you know, I had to beat those guys up on principle. We know that he shot two off-duty police cops who were legitimately harassing and beating up a black man. But we rarely tie all of these things together. Mm. We rarely ask ourselves, how is it that someone can have a clean record, cannot actually be in a criminal life until they make it in Hollywood? And all of a sudden they've got all of these cases, cases which bear hallmarks of the harassment and the legal exhaustion that his mom and his elders went through. So I think Tupac was a budding revolutionary who had revolutionary projects on the table, which again, we don't know about. There are interviews where he hints that thug life is more than a tattoo on his stomach. It's more than a group. There is a philosophy behind it. And when you read up on the code of thug life and what it achieved in the prison systems, as well as the streets in the early 90s, and how he aligned with the political prisoners of the first wave of Black Panthers, you realize that there was a lot more to Tupac than meets the eye.
Because for me, I wonder about Tupac's journey between first living album, last living album, Tupacalypse Now, where you've got Brenda's Got a Baby, you've got all of the social commentary about the world around him. And then you've got All Eyes on Me, where you've got like Hit 'Em Up, which, like, yes, it's not socially conscious. Is it a banger? Absolutely. absolutely.
Best diss track ever. I'm sorry.
Like, it is. I mean, I don't know why people always say Ether's better than Hit 'Em Up.
It's pure propaganda.
Like,
pure propaganda.
It's just nonsense. Yeah. Because for me, the beautiful part of Hit 'Em Up, what a way to use the word beautiful, is when you don't think he's rapping anymore and you think he's just shouting into the mic. And there's something about that breakdown of the form, but the beat's still going and you've still got the like backing singers being like, take money.
Yeah, and he's just going off.
Going like, you know, don't you have sickle cell or something? He's just going... Like,
shouts out to my sickle cell community. You know, my cousin's got sickle cell. It's not a joke, of course.
It's not a joke, but it's how deep he was going and the sort of like, it was deep, but also infantile at the same time. And I think there's something about walking that line, which I found fascinating. But that journey, right, from Brenda's Got a Baby to something like Hit 'Em Up, I'm going, was he still the same Tupac by the end of his life? Was he still wedded to the principles of black radicalism, black liberation, and indeed Marxism? Or was he, like many young men, going through a phase where he's been entranced by glamour, a particular kind of masculinity, a proximity to violence, which is both frightening and thrilling, that maybe if he'd lived a bit longer, he'd have moved out of again?
So it's really hard to talk about Tupac in a short space of time because I think all the above is true. But I also think that underlying it all was a radical intention. There are interviews from 1996 where he's talking very candidly. He's out of prison. Unfortunately, yes, he is with Death Row Records. And he's saying, next step, political party. You have never heard a rapper in Tupac's position at the top of the game, transcending hip hop in their early mid 20s, talking about turning hip hop into a political party. You've never heard that again. There's a good reason for that. I think the American establishment understood what hip hop, what Tupac's project was with hip hop. They understood that this guy actually has the training. This guy's done the reading. This guy is a direct descendant of the Black Liberation Army. People that took pride in military training, in the prospect of an armed conflict, an armed standoff with the state. They tried to lock his mom up for 25 years when she was pregnant with him. So I think the American establishment knew. We didn't know. We didn't know how seriously America was taking Tupac. And it's taken me a long time to this day when I present this this view on Tupac to a lot of rap fans, a lot of Black people in general. They find it really hard to believe that the American government could have taken a skinny little rapper that seriously.
Do you think they had an involvement with his death?
I think there's irrefutable evidence to suggest that there were coincidences around Tupac's death, you know, bearing in mind this occurred on the Las Vegas Strip, one of the busiest, probably most photographed places in the world at the time. There are too many coincidences to not look into possible involvement by the state, especially when you then go on, which I didn't get space to do in this book, when you go on to look at the death of Biggie and the role of the LAPD, the proven role of the LAPD in terms of the death of Biggie, and some of the dirty cops and the very questionable relationship between the LAPD and the FBI in that whole nexus of events.
I mean, you talk in the book about the project of killing off viable Black leadership in terms of Patrice Lumumba, Thomas Sankara, Fred Hampton, and of course, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. What do you think the impact of that has been?
Insurmountable, man. I mean, damn near insurmountable. I think the impact of killing off all this Black leadership, this radical, people-committed Black leadership, there are various dimensions. Firstly, there is a myth that Black people can't find good leaders. With all of these guys removed from the scene and ultimately erased from memory through their true narrative being corrupted in mainstream media, never taught in mainstream education, there is plausible deniability with the colonial powers, with the imperial powers to say, look, these guys just can't get it together. They keep giving into dictatorship. They keep giving into tribalism. They keep selling off their country's resources for the low. They're just, you know, they just can't be helped. The CEO of Blackwater recently made similar pronouncements. That's one element. The idea that we just can't find good leaders for Black people. Another element is that the epistemology, like the way we pass on the knowledge, the way those leaders, if they had prevailed, would have ensured that the generations after them were educated, would have ensured that the institutions that they left in their wake represented the values that they fought for, the values that they died for. If those guys had a chance to complete their projects, then there would have been an institutional memory in a lot of these Black populations to say, look, these are the tactics of empire. This is how they divide us. This is how our coalitions are undermined from the outset. This is where military standoffs lead to. This is where this is the character of their economic system. This is what our options are beyond that. But we don't have much of that conversation in mainstream Black places. I have made a podcast for like 5 years now that started off speaking about the Black British experience and has now ended up speaking about the Black experience around the world. And there's just no mainstream outlet for this podcast in this country. There's no mainstream black intellectualism, black critique. There's no mainstream space for me to just be an artist that does. I don't want to talk to you about my relationship and or my relationships and whatever trauma I might be carrying over from my personal life and my neighborhood when I remember it back in the day when it had the height of all of its problems. I don't want to talk about that.
I was murdered 5 times before the age of 9.
I wasn't shot 9 times. I wasn't, you know, like that didn't happen to me. And the people that it did happen to would rather I spoke to you about something a little more meaningful than dredging up all of their worst moments and dredging up my community's worst moments for a career.
They won't write about that. Books about where we come from. That's why we're heroes on our junction.
You understand. So this is what we're really up against. And, there is no space for this kind of analysis unless it's, you know, independent leftist media, but anything explicitly black in this country, we're still in the process of building it.
One of the things which I often think of when I reflect on the South Asian community in Britain is that there is a history of South Asian radicalism in this country. South All Black Sisters, Newham Monitoring Project involved a lot of Asian people, the fight against the far right in Newham as well. That was a lot of like tooled up Bengalis a lot of the time.
Right.
But how the community now understands itself and its own story, it's quite model minority. So we will send our children to medical school and to law school. They will become owners of property and we'll be the good ones. And who we're defining ourselves against very often are working class black people and more working class Pakistanis and Bangladeshis.
Right.
Do you see the beginnings of that kind of model minority story being told within factions of the black community?
Black African community, definitely. I see that emerging. And prior to this narrative emerging, specifically about the Nigerians, it was in the black working class, we used to hold up elements of the British Asian community, maybe even the British Asian community as a whole, we used to hold them up as model minorities and we used to beat ourselves.
Why
can't we be like them? And you know, the Asians, the Indians work together. I was like, do you know how many Indians hate each other? Do you know how many different types of migration there have been across the so-called British Asian community and how much variation there is in terms of the outcomes that they've been able to secure for themselves in this country? But yeah, because of the death of radicalism, or the suffocation of radicalism, radical analysis in our day-to-day lives, in our media, in our education systems, we are not in the habit of looking at each other along these forms of analysis. We won't hear about all of this resistance that happened from the Bengali community. I hear about this from my friend's parents, my Asian friend's parents who were there at the time. We don't look at the synergy between, you know, the nature of our migration and what was done by the empire in our home countries. So ultimately, we end up looking at each other from points of difference and trying to assess our progress in terms that are imposed on us and conditioned into our thinking, largely by the imperial ruling class.
I mean, sticking with this idea of points of difference for a moment, you had a very radical, very effective anti-racist movement in the 70s and 80s organizing under a deeply flawed banner. And that flawed banner was political blackness. I really understand why people don't want to use that term anymore. But it seems to me that we haven't come up with an umbrella for the experience of racialized people, which allows us to work together. And maybe where we're at now is this idea of, well, everyone works on their own struggle separately because there's too much anti-blackness in the Asian community or there's too much Islamophobia in the black community. And we can't work together without fighting each other. So we may as well just do our own thing. I mean, what's your point of view on the benefits and pitfalls of separate strands of struggle?
I've been having this conversation about Gaza. There are elements of, I don't want to say the black community, but let's say online discourse from black spaces that argue that Gaza can't be a priority. There are, you know, Africans have enough problems of their own. Black Americans have enough problems of their own. And there's so much anti-blackness in the Arab community, Palestine notwithstanding, that there's just basically no point. I mean, I can't articulate their position. I can't articulate this argument well because I hold it in very low regard. I don't take it seriously. So I'll come out and say that. I think it's convenient. I think it's convenient to say that, oh, I'm so busy with my struggle that I'm not going to engage with a struggle that's parallel, that's identical to mine, on the grounds that there might be some people on that side who don't prioritize my struggle when I'm feeling the heat. I think that's convenient. I think it's disingenuous to ignore the fact that it is also safer to not get involved in some of these struggles, Palestine in particular.
The cost of speaking out being so high.
Exactly. You know, if people led with that and said, look, I really feel for those people. I'm just, you know, I'm scared for my career. I'm in a precarious situation. I can't afford to gamble with my voice right now. I would have a little more respect for that. But for people that say, I can't find allyship, I can't be an ally across racial barriers or national barriers because we have so many problems, I feel like they're completely misreading the game. I think they're underestimating the extent to which, or maybe they're overestimating the extent to which the colonial imperial forces of the world like each other.
Mm.
These guys don't team up because they like each other. They sense and they identify shared interests in holding on to their ill-gotten gains, long story short.
Yeah, I mean, like, look at the response to the self-emancipation of AET slaves, right? The British and the French did not like each other. They didn't like slaves freeing themselves a whole lot more.
100%. And all of a sudden, they find some common ground. So if we're not thinking along those lines, you know, I spoke about the cab driver that brought me here. He's from Brazil. I was asking him his read on Brazilian politics. And I asked him, like, you know, America or China, who would you prefer to align with? And he said, you know, he preferred America for various reasons. I understood his logic. But what I appreciated about his view was that he had an international view and he understood that BRICS, you know, Brazil's potential role in the BRICS formation is forward facing. It is, you know, looking to a potentially multipolar world. And if we're not thinking along those lines, if we're not thinking about our international formations, our international alliances, knowing that there's no longer, you know, a USSR that's necessarily ideologically, you know, different from what America represents. And knowing that, I don't know, man, knowing that, you know, we're now dealing with 60 years of neocolonialism to where our apparent leaders in our home country are very much compromised. we need to think, you know, in broader terms. So I'm not really with that narrow nationalism.
You know what I think a really good and useful rule of thumb is, and it's a friend of mine who came up with it. He went, whenever you're being pulled into a discourse that says, maybe I can never work with these people, stop and ask yourself, are the CIA happy or sad that I'm thinking this way? And I was like, that's such a good rule of thumb.
Bullseye.
Is that you just stop and you go, does the CIA approve or disapprove of the fact I'm doing this? And then you go back and you look through the CIA manual of PSYOPs.
Yeah.
And a lot of the behaviors that they say for, you know, intelligence disruptors who are infiltrating movements of, like, be disruptive, always bring up reasons why things can't happen, always bring it back to, like, irreducible differences. We're doing that ourselves.
Amazing.
On Twitter.
I mean, again, to go back to a case study that I put forward in the book, in fact, to return to the case of the Black Panthers, a lot of what was put in place there, which ultimately reiterated itself in the so-called East Coast, West Coast beef of the 90s with 90s hip hop, was elements of the West Coast Panthers feeling fundamentally alienated from the East Coast Panthers. But you guys are Black Panthers. You're both from the radical element of Black America. Now, if you guys feel like you have irreconcilable differences, of course, this is in the context of sabotage, of letters being sent by the FBI, infiltration, of course, and all sorts of media misdirection. Very, very unfortunate episodes in Panther history. If you guys, of all people, find that you have irreconcilable differences, what might that indicate about our broader condition? But again, another thing that I've realized is a lot of people don't know what the CIA is. A lot of people don't know what the FBI is. They don't understand the role, the significant role that these organizations play in shaping the outcomes of the world.
One of the things that struck me most about reading about that period of history with the Black Panthers is how happy they were to make allies who were different from themselves. So that might have been the young patriots who were essentially poor whites. It might have been with the Puerto Rican young lords, of course, Puerto Rican. And it was also with the Viet Cong. And so you would have these delegations of Vietnamese meeting with the Black Panthers, and the Panthers would have organized burning of the draft cards. So it wasn't saying, we refuse conscription. We're not going to go over there and fight you. And at one such, you know, kind of delegation, the Viet Cong said, and we are the Yellow Panthers.
Right.
And so there was this learning from each other, and there was a willingness to also play on the weak points of the imperial project. Very famously, Hanoi Hannah, who was the radio presenter who would, you know, beam out the frequencies to American GIs, speaking only to Black GIs, saying, you know what they're doing to you back home? Why are you here fighting us? And I think that there was a willingness to strategize differently from how we're doing it now.
Right. I think coalition building is the big challenge that the global left faces. I was speaking to an Arab friend of mine who was talking about the response to the genocide and was bemoaning, you know, infighting within his own situation, within his own context, feeling that people get really territorial about not aligning with this element of the Arab world who allowed this or facilitated that, or this particular Arab person who was wrong on that issue that is not even Gaza related. Some other thing that happened, whether it would be Egypt or Syria. And he was just really frustrated that at this time, you know, it's really hard to get consensus across the board that we're going to set aside our maybe lower priority points of difference in order to form a united front for this existential, I don't even know what you want to call it.
Horror.
Horror. That's the word, horror.
There would be those who are supportive of Keir Starmer's Labour Party that would say, your refusal to give him your backing is you splitting hairs over differences and you refusing to form a broad coalition against the Tories. How would you respond to them?
The writing's on the wall, mate. And you're not reading it. Keir Starmer's a Tory. Obviously.
And by Tory, you mean doesn't matter what colour rosette you're wearing.
Right.
These are your values.
These are your values. These are your outcomes. This is what your policy is going to lead to. Not only is he an imperialist, not only does he clearly place the lower value on Palestinian life that the rest of the imperial order does. He's also not even for the working class of Britain. Like, he's also willing to participate in a class war against, you know, his, what's supposed to be his domestic priority electorate. And the fact that he can be so unabashedly these things in, you know, in your face prior to an election, knowing that, you know, things are looking in his favor, that suggests to me that he has no intention of changing, reforming, moving in a progressive direction once elected. So it's just really a non-starter, isn't it?
Do you think, I mean, we know that the political consensus between Tories and Labour at the moment, we know it's bad for migrants, we know it's bad for people of colour, we know it's bad for working class people. Do you think they even serve white people particularly well?
No, that's my whole point about my man. No, like, I don't think he cares. These guys don't care about you stupid working class people, you know, as how they feel. They don't care. I was just following you lot's analysis of the donor that contributed like what, four and a half million to the Labour Party, whose son is now the leader of the Labour youth segment or whatever it is. And Helena from your team was made a very good point that this is indicative of the return with a vengeance of the professional class. Labour is for the, politics is for the professional class. And she gave all sorts of examples of working class champions within the Labour Party who are being pushed out and sidelined in favour of people that are maybe more aligned with the establishment.
It's the KPMG class.
Right, there you go.
And it feels like, now they've come back with Keir Starmer being their man to get them back inside and back at the helm of the levers of power in the Labour Party.
Yeah.
It reminded me of what Talleyrand said about the Bourbon Restoration in the 19th century. They learned nothing and they forgot nothing.
Right. And while we're on that point, I think it's also important to, you know, maintain an international lens and ask yourself, what do you expect different from Starmer as in comparison to Biden and ultimately what Bernie became or was poised to become if he did, you know, move into a more senior position in the Democratic Party? We've seen how this plays out. You lot are trying to scare me with what the Tories are, but I just don't see any material difference with what Labour is right now.
George the Poet, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been one of the most enjoyable conversations I've ever had on this show.
Bless you. Thank you very much for giving me your time. Thanks for reading my book. And, you know,
there's so much that's interesting in here and we barely scratched the surface. And this is going to be, you know, one of the few times where I talk directly into the camera about a book. There are so many asides in this book, which could be chapters all on their own. So read it, but read it with a pencil in your hand because you're going to want to underline it.
Thank you very much. Track Record, Me, Music and the War on Blackness. It will be out by the end of April. Ash, thank you very much. I was very nervous about this one, as you probably
can't
tell.
Have been
I
nervous.
Feel like I just vomited a lot of words a lot of the time, but it is cool. It's because I have a lot of respect for you.
This was really, really great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support independent journalism and set up a regular donation to Navara Media from just £1 a month. Head to navara.media/support.